This is July 6th, St. Augustine, Florida, Reel 2. We're talking to Ms. Hall, who is staff costumer of Cross and Sword. Hi, Ms. Hall, I have a question regarding the materials used in the costumes. In working on the designs and in taking care of them over last summer and then in working on them again this year, have you found that there are materials to be avoided in outdoor drama production, or are there special materials that stand up, let's say, longer than average?
Regarding the costumes from last year, we have used corduroy to substitute velvet. And from the distance, it looks just as rich. And nobody knows it's corduroy, really. And corduroy, of course, holds up very well and holds up better than velvet, because velvet has a smooth, is very smooth, and any wrinkle shows and it gets discolored, while corduroy lasts much better. And for example, for settler costumes, a heavy cotton lined with a good material, good lining material, holds up very well. We have used some inexpensive lining materials, and after so many dry cleanings, it shrank and just wasn't worth it, really, to buy an inexpensive material.
One of the things I notice here this time of year, it's very hot. Sweat stains or damp costumes from sweat affect the materials or speed up the time you would normally have to wash them? What change does this heat make in the playing of the play? If you were an inside air-conditioned theater, I'm sure the problem would be a little different. There may not be a problem here. I just ask, is there a problem?
Well, I would say the main problem is the actors themselves. If they would hang their costumes up and leave spaces in between, naturally they get very sweaty. They would dry by the next evening, but it doesn't always happen here.
Well, this brings to mind probably our final question, and that is, in terms of the actors who wear your costumes, is there anything in terms of their training, either in the wearing or the care of the costumes, that you would like to see improved in the performers?
I found that it does not make any difference how old an actor is, whether it is a young Indian or a professional actor at the age of 30. I did not find enough discipline and responsibility. They really don't care. And if their costume is misplaced, they expect me to find it in the costume shop, and it's really not there, it's in their dressing room. And I feel there should be much more order, and superiors should be much more strict to get people, actors, to care more for their costumes. And I don't know if it would be helpful to, in early training, to instill this into them, or whether it depends on each different place where they perform, whether they should do it.
It's unfair of me to ask about the property, since that's not your department. I would venture to guess, if this is true, it may also be true in the properties. Have you heard any complaints from that department, since we're not interviewing them on this particular session?
I think that goes as well for the properties, because...
Let me ask yes. Another question. I'll take you off the hook so that you don't have to speak for the property people past that point. Do you find a difference between the performers who had dance training and work as dancers in terms of artistic discipline that you're speaking of, between them and the actor performers?
Actually, I don't see much difference as far as our cast this year is concerned anyway. And I think it just depends on the personality of the person itself. For example, we have one actor who is, I made him a brand new costume, and he was very, very happy with it, and he was pleased with the colors and fit and comfort and everything. And he is so proud of his costume, he just hangs it very, very carefully on a hanger, and nobody may touch it, and that's the best looking costume still. And I feel it is very important as well to please the actor as far as color is concerned, at least. Because I did have this problem once this year. An important actress was happy with my choice of costume for her, and someone else did not want that, and she was very unhappy about it, and her performance wasn't as good. So I feel if there can be made a compromise, they will care more for their costume, and I think the overall will be a much happier picture.
All right, we've been talking to Miss Hall, costume mistress for Cross and Sword, St. Augustine. Linda, that's the end of this one. I'll be back with you a little later. Linda, I'm talking to Frank Ray, choreographer for Cross and Sword at St. Augustine, July 6, 1966. Frank, dance is an important part of this production, important not only in the design of the decorative part of the production, but it is a storytelling part. And I would like to ask you if there were particular problems in blending these two together, just in handling this particular production, and then we'll talk a little bit about specific. You're looking at me with a puzzled look. You don't understand the question, shall I make it go back over it? I was speaking in reference to the fact that the dance is called for and is a part of the environmental action of part of the scenes. But you have approached two spots in the play where you have used dance to do the storytelling itself. The parts I'm referring to, of course, are the building of St. Augustine and the hurricane, which are both high points in the play. And I wondered if, in working it out, there were any particular problems, or that if you felt this bridged the style, or if you just deliberately bridged the style for the effect.
The problem, I think, was not to make it too stylized, too much of a dance form within itself. It had to be, for example, the harvest dance. I felt it was necessary because of the nature of our play in particular, that I don't go too far out on it. That it has to be realistic enough that the audience can comprehend what is happening quickly. There's not very much time, you know, allowed for the dance at that particular time. And we have to represent in that dance all of the work that had been done by the people to establish their food products and so on. You know. And so it was necessary that we keep it within the style of the play. Now, if this play had not been surrounding this dance, I would not have treated it this way.
I think personally that the storytelling quality, which works almost like a montage in a motion picture, mm-hmm. of scene upon scene to very fast tell part of the story, has worked much better than narration would. I think this is an exciting thing myself. Well, the specific questions that I wanted to ask, Frank, you've done a number of outdoor shows, and what do you find to be the particular advantages of playing outdoors? You enjoy it? Well, you obviously do because you work on them all the time.
I really enjoy it more than anything else I've ever done. And the reason for it is the play itself. Usually, the playwright for outdoor drama gives you such a tremendous scope. You know, where else can you get a hurricane and a harvest dance and Spanish dancing and Indian dance and so on? Where usually you have a contemporary play and all the dances are contemporary, or it's Kismet and everything has to be of that particular, you know, culture and so on. But here in outdoor drama, we always have, as choreographers, such a fabulous opportunity to create so many different things. And this, I think, is a great advantage.
Does the space, in terms of side stages, main stages and such, often broken up by scenery, is this a problem or do you find it an advantage? Is it a challenge or
well,
is it...
It can be both. At times it has been a great disadvantage because I couldn't create the intimate quality in a dance that I would want. You say. And I would have to spread it out simply because the space was there and it had to be used because of the nature of the scene. But it works both ways pretty well.
In approaching this then, you give us something of the disadvantages. Are there disadvantages to either to you as choreographer or to the performers as they dance in the outdoor theaters that you've worked in? I'm speaking of all types of things like weather, like stage floors, that anything that you would care to comment on that might we might take up with the architects for some of the new theaters.
Well, I'm particularly bothered with things, for example, in the hurricane. No matter how hard we try, we still get the, even over the wind and over the music and so on, we get the scraping sounds of the feet. This bothers me, you know. In the Harvest Dance, for example, the scraping shoes where there should not be this sound. Of course, when it's wet, it becomes very slick, and that's a difficult
problem. What type of floor? This is a combination of wood and in some cases
wood, and it's covered
concrete,
with a canvas. Actually, this has been a great advantage as far as the dancers are concerned when they have to do leaps and jumps and so on, you know. But for other things, it does have its disadvantage.
You were mentioning the advantage for the performers. How do you mean this? What is the specific problem here in terms of other shows?
And this floor, you mean?
Yes, where is its advantage?
Well, for example, in doing jumps or leaps and so on, it has a springy quality. So instead of coming down to a hard cement.
You're comparing this to
Harrodsburg
or Williamsburg,
for example, or Williamsburg with the tar, I believe it is, that we had there, and or just simply the ground itself. This has tremendous advantages that way. And of course, I'm crazy about the levels as a choreographer. I just think the levels are fabulous because you can do so much more in spacing and everything else.
Do you find the weather works a hardship on you?
Yes, very much so. If we have too much dew or rain the night before or the afternoon before, it becomes a problem. But if we didn't have this problem, it wouldn't be quite as much fun.
Frank, in terms of the relationship to the audience, which as it is to the director, is important to the choreographer, do you find there are changes or any design changes that are necessary for you to make coming out in this big theater that goes 180 degrees around the forward part of the audience, or do you just dance it in terms of the space? I don't know whether my question is quite clear here, but are there differences in the relationship between the dancers and the audience, the play in the audience, outdoors, as opposed to what indoor work you've done?
No, other than the obvious difference, in that when I have to choreograph, for example, and I'm not sure if this is what you want to know, I find that I have to be very conscious of certain steps, for example, that would look very good in a small theater, but the minute that you put them on this much area, they get lost, and so you have to plan so that the largeness of outdoor drama is used to an advantage. You have to watch out for certain patterns that just will not show through.
Well, this is exactly the thing I wanted to know. I wanted to ask Frank, what differences in the consumption of energy are made by dancing outdoors? Is there anything noticeable in terms of changing from indoor to outdoor? Do the dancers have to put out more energy outdoors? Is it a factor at all?
Yes, it's definitely a factor because most movements have to be larger. The type of choreography that is involved is usually much more strenuous. The small things, again, which you usually use as red steps or to give the dancer time to just do one or two things of great deal of vitality, this has to be sustained for longer time in outdoor drama.
I could go from there into a little discussion of artistic discipline, but let's save that for just a minute. Frank, I forgot the point that I wanted to make, but let's move on to another item, and that is regarding the training that the young dancer performer gets before you see them. Are there comments that you could make to us, either for teachers or for would-be performers, on the type of training that they should have, or any gaps in training that you observe in the people that audition for you, or the people that have danced in the shows you've choreographed?
First of all, let me say that I feel that the training has improved greatly in the last 4 years. Every time I've gone up to Chapel Hill, for example, the crop is so much better than it was the year before. It seems to be constantly improving. I think the big lack is that not enough colleges and professional schools and dance studios and so on are giving them enough of a variation in their background. For example, so many of the students specialize in modern or specialize in ballet and nothing else, where they should have a variety of work. They should specialize, certainly, but they should have, for example, a person who's specializing in ballet should also get a little bit of modern. Even a little bit of tap wouldn't hurt them. Or some ethnic. Most of the kids come and they have no concept of Spanish dance or Hindu or any of the other forms of dance and are just totally indoctrinated in one form. We need to have more all-around dancers who are also specialists in a particular field.
Linda, stop right here and write a note and put on my desk, handwritten is fine, reminding me to get a contact with Dance Magazine and make sure we have a folder, address, and personnel there, and if I can't find it in the contact book and the others, to write Frank Ray. The phone was ringing, I'll repeat that. Make a note, and just a handwritten note, and put it on my desk, reminding me to make contact of some kind with Dance Magazine, and if I can't find the information, to write Frank Ray, and he'll send it to us. One final comment, Frank. I wonder if you would comment on the level of artistic discipline of the dancers you see as they come to you at auditions and as they come into your company. Do you find that their attitudes toward the work that they're doing are professional, that they keep their minds on it? This is a loaded question, partly because some of the stage directors have complained that the young people coming to them do not have a sufficient professional approach.
Well, I'll have to say that out of the people that I hire, 98.9% do have a professional attitude. Because I feel it's my job only to hire those who do. And if they don't, then I don't want them. And so it's very simple. Now, I do have kids, for example, who forget and will get a little bit too much sun, you know, this type of thing. But generally speaking, their discipline, their work is extremely good. Their professional attitude is just excellent. Now, I'm not comparing them to indoctrinated and weathered professionals. But these are students who are people who are beginning in their professional life. And generally speaking, they're very well disciplined.
I've been talking to Frank Ray, St. Augustine, Florida. This will echo something else, Linda, but would you make a note, just a separate sheet to go in the reports, that a staff member at St. Augustine indicated that in his experience with outdoor drama that a large part of the problems concerned with artistic discipline and training level are due to the fact that many of the shows pay so little in terms of salary for either dancers or performers that they cannot get the people with the best training from colleges or from whatever source, and that part of the problems of the untrained or semi-trained actor are part of the problems of hiring poor talent from an income or salary scale level. Linda, this is another part of the interview with Frank Ray, so you might put a little extra sheet in the typewriter. Frank, I would like to ask you, in terms of this show and other shows that you've choreographed or have worked on, to what extent is the choreographer tied to the actual folk dance or the primitive dance historically? Do you actually have to research this, or do you catch the flavor of it and then step out? What is the pattern, and does it vary from show to show in demands on the choreographer?
My approach is, first of all, to read the script and find out what the dance is supposed to say, and pray that the playwright has given the dance something to say. Then I go to whatever source is necessary. For example, in our particular show now, the Spanish dance, I research the Spanish dancing of the period. And then, after doing the research, then I choreograph not perhaps the exact actual steps, which would be perhaps boring to the audience if they were extended, but I keep it within the flavor of the people and the flavor of the period. The same thing is done in the Indian dances. There was not too much information to be found, but from reading about their lives and how they hunted and the burial ceremonies and so on, I could color everything so that you wouldn't look at it and say, oh my goodness, you know, we've got a bunch of Martha Graham Indian dancers, you know, that type of thing. I think that you must keep within the style so that you're not obviously deviating from the nature of the scene.
That's all of that, Linda. And I'll let you rest now for a minute. Linda?
Yeah.
Linda, I'm talking to Mr. Ron Jarrett, technical director and lighting designer for Cross and Sword, St. Augustine, July 6, 1966. Mr. Jarrett, and if I jump up and down, it's because I'm looking to see whether we're picking everything up. It has an adapter, but I don't. Linda, restart. I'm talking to Mr. Ron Jarrett, the technical director, scene designer, and lighting designer for Cross and Sword, St. Augustine, Florida, July 6, 1966. Ron, the first question I would like to ask you is a rather all-inclusive one. And I wonder if you could point out what, in your opinion, are the greatest advantages of outdoor production. What do you like about it most? What do you find to be the greatest artistic challenge?
Well, I think probably the biggest single advantage you have going for you is what could be called a utility atmosphere, which you don't have to create because you are out of doors. And I think this probably creates the same kind of, not the same kind, but a spirit similar to walking into what's often called a festival theater, where the theater building itself contains some of the spirit of the production before the curtain goes up. This would be like an opera house or some ballet houses. So in the out of doors, you've got this priming of the audience, I think, through the natural surroundings, the atmosphere that's already there. And I think this is one of the biggest single advantages going for you. Other advantages, I guess I haven't thought too much. I tend to see outdoor drama and indoor drama as two very different things. And also, I'd like to look at outdoor drama as a form, something unto itself and unique. And there is not a great deal that applies when you begin comparing the success of one outdoor production with an indoor production, so I just like to take it on its own terms.
I would like to ask you, as a designer, do you find the increase in space, at least the increase over most of the indoor theaters, does it present you with a greater opportunity?
I think it presents you with a different kind of a problem, a very challenging problem.
Well, let's depart from there then and go into some of the problems as you have faced them in designing the show.
The problem is that you take the space that you're working in, the entire visual field that you're working in or trying to create, including all the vertical scenery, the actor in his costume, the lighting, whatever break in stage level or platforms you're using, and you suddenly increase those tremendously in scale. And there's got to be an accompanying device or way for increasing the scale of the actor as kind of a plastic motor material. And if you can't take him up in scale at the same time, well, that space is going to eat him up. And he's going to have a hard time filling it. There are a lot of different devices, but I think this is one of the real critical issues. Like a playwright obviously plays a major role in trying to lend scale to individual characterization. And I think it becomes a designer's problem to try and find ways to increase the scale of the human form so that every movement, every line, every positioning of crowds and so on is not lost simply because of the scale of the space.
Ron, in designing, did you work, I assume you worked with the script and with the director in arriving at the designs. Did you have, this is because of comments made by some other designers, did you have sufficient time with the script and with the amphitheater design in hand before the production the first year?
Well, I had sufficient, as far as the amphitheater was concerned, I had sufficient time because I worked over here for about 2 years before, prior to obtaining a script. So I had a chance to come over on weekends and get a feel for the space we were working in, and then making decisions about where the light towers would be located and how deep the stage would be and how wide. So I had a pretty good idea of the problems that this particular space was going to create. As far as the script goes, the set was designed long before the script was finished. And this may or may not have created some problems. It's hard to say at this point. Chances are that if the script had been finished 6 to 8 months before the show was to open, and I had had that time to work on a design for a specific script, either I would have come up with something similar or the designs would have been rejected, as not being suitable to that particular script. That's about all I can say.
I'm not trying to put you on the spot. The question I'm asking is brought up because I have had a bitter complaint from two other designers on two other projects who complained of the fact that they were given scene outlines, and then by the time the finished script came to them, they found they had designed scenery for some scenes that didn't exist and still had to design scenery for some scenes that were yet to be written, and they felt that they had essentially not had an opportunity to do the full job. And I didn't mean to load it at all, except that I think it's a pertinent point to our playwrights that they bloody well finish the scripts in time for people to work with.
It is a very pertinent point. I think that before a designer begins, and in this case, I worked on the set before a director was selected and before the play was finished. But I think one principle always holds true, that regardless of who starts working on the show first, he's got to work toward some controlling idea or principle or style. This may be a personal style, or it might be something that somebody else has categorized and he's trying to, in the best sense of the word, imitate it. And that does take time. And if in the middle of this process there's going to be some interruption and a complete change in direction, so that the original controlling idea is lost, then this would do, I think, an awful lot of damage to the show. And it's likely to deprive it of whatever this thing we call style.
I might comment that a show that I was near one time built a rather costly set. It's one of 15 sets to be built. This one set for the show cost $5,000. And it was junked before the dress rehearsal started. But after it was completed, the $5,000 had just as soon been turned into scrap, and of course it was, in order to get anything out of it at all. So that it's not only costly in terms of artistic design and values, but it's costly just in terms of cold, hard cash before you ever open. The artistic problems may cause problems later. We all know that. I didn't mean to wander astray there, but this, I guess, for the designer who is too cramped in terms of thinking time, a very severe problem.
In answer to that, you know, I guess the best answer to that question is, Mark, I had something in mind to work with. So at times it would have been tremendously helpful to at least know a sequence of scenes. But on the other hand, I had an idea in mind for treatment of the show, so I was never at a loss. I could always keep working.
Yeah.
But what I was
yeah.
pursuing was, you know, a style concept before there was a finished script.
Which is the difficult way to do it, if I may comment.
It may or may not be. My feeling is that in some cases it's best if the three or four or five people who have got some part in the artistic end of the show for a while work independently, that they all, you know, go their own way.
Linda, we're running low on this tape. Rewind at this point and we'll continue on the other reel.